This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run backdoor play if they can get it.
Under 10. Backdoor.
Goes out. Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it. Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
My guest today, if you're a basketball fan or a coach, is a living legend. From Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, he was an impactful coach at Princeton for 29 years, a leader really in how to teach the game, highly respected college coach and then an NBA assistant. Coach Kirill has seen so much in hoops, and he's been involved in so many different ways in the lives of so many coaches that you know, John Thompson, Bill Carmody, Chris Mooney, Mike Brennan, myself, just to name a few. He's a friend now, a mentor, my coach. I sat down with Coach to discuss, you know, his life, his very full life, starting in Bethlehem and beyond. And I felt this was so good that I wanted to split it up into two parts. So I really hope you'll enjoy this. I think that it captures someone that's been very special to me and very special to Princeton basketball.
Coach, this is a real pleasure for me because, you know, it's one of those moments where I feel like the shoe's on the other foot a little bit. We get to talk about you. Tell me about your parents growing up in Bethlehem, PA. You know, you're the son of Spanish immigrants.
My dad was from northern Spain, the province of León, and he was a steel worker there. And they have a city there, Bilbao, right on the Bay of Biscay. It's closer to France. And that's the steel-making capital of Spain. And they also have an international jazz concert there every year. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
No.
But they flock there to Spain for that. My mom was from Salamanca, which is a teaching, one of the best universities in Europe there for teaching. And so they came over here, I would say, around 1926. That's when there was a civil war going on in Spain. And
how did they end up in Bethlehem?
Well, he started out in Buffalo first, where they had a plant there. Bethlehem Steel had a plant in Buffalo. Then they went to the main. He went to the main. They needed some workers there in Bethlehem, so they moved to Bethlehem, where they stayed for most of their lives. And they, at that one time, they just... they had 36,000 people there working
at the
plant.
At
right?
Steel.
And just the other day, I was elected to the Hall of Fame of Bethlehem, which was very interesting because they had three NFL football players there from our high school.
This is Liberty High School.
Liberty High School. And then the stage was right in front of the blast furnaces. I mean, you could just turn around, you'd see them. They were so tall. And the history of steel making in that town was so immense. It was unbelievable. And I mentioned during my speech there that I'd hope that the strength of that town was the family at that time. And a lot of those guys went to war. The manager of our high school basketball team, Bert Clevenger, was killed during the Korean War. And there were about four Spanish families that lost sons during World War II. Chuck Benarek, the most famous Bethlehem grad who played for Penn, he just passed away. He had 25 missions as a gunner. I don't know how he ever got into the plane, as big as he was. And then we had a guy taught me how to play. It was a guy named Al Samer, who was on Guadalcanal, and they said he had 200 bullet holes in him. I don't believe that, but his stitches run all the way down his body.
Now this guy taught you how to play basketball.
Yeah.
Okay, I've never heard about him.
I was a young kid at the time at that boys club, and
you mentioned the boys club. You talked about this a lot.
Everybody in that part of town who stayed out of trouble, went to the boys' club. It was very good. Had very good discipline there. The leaders of the club were, I'll just mention names, John Betts and Joe Hasek and Steve Horvath, unbelievable. You had a sign in when you walked in. You had to cross your number 50 cents a year to join, and then a dollar if you had a job. And then you had to take your hat off when you walked in there. And then you went right to whatever the activity you were interested in, which might have been, they had a library there. They had a lot of pool tables. I spent a lot of time on that. And then they had a gym upstairs where you played. It's an incredible place. And they affected the way you behave. And then they had a camp for the summer, which I went to as a dishwasher. They called them gushies in those days, 50 cents a week. And then I wound up being the head counselor, where I got $2 a week. But they only charge you $7.50 a week. And the camp was all about athletics.
Mm-hmm.
That track meet days, it was Thursday. Boxing was Friday. I mean, archery, they did everything. It's unreal. And, of course, you went down to the swimming meet. They had there right on the Delaware River. So my life was, at that time, was really comfortable, I thought.
Yeah, you've always said you really appreciate growing up there. Who were your academic influences for you? And how did you get it so interested? Because you ended up teaching history in government and economics a little bit in high school, but in your early part of your life.
Well, I had I was always an athletic guy, a guy named Jack Conte, who was the junior high coach, and his sons were linebackers at Syracuse, very good players, and he was always on you to make sure you did your studying. Was really a football coach, but he was a disciplinarian on the basketball court, so we won a title, I guess, 2 years that I played there. He only played six games because there are four junior high schools, and a lot of the athletes from that time came from that school or Washington, which was on right up the other end of the steel mill, because the steel mill was four miles long. From one town to the end of the town to the other, so you had to go through it. Any of them, you'd see how big it was, and there was a place there we used to play in the stone piles of cement and all that kind of stuff, and they're chased out by the police of the Bethlehem Steel, and then now it's one of the most lucrative gambling sites in the United States. So the town has changed so much there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I'm off track a little bit.
No. And so you played more than just basketball when you got to high school.
Well, I tried football, but, to tell you the truth, I didn't like getting hit as hard as I did. And you could any time you weighed 125 pounds, everybody wanted to tackle you. So that wasn't so good. Then it kept me away from basketball because I loved to play basketball. I couldn't play baseball. From the time I played baseball till I went into service and took a test to be a pilot in the Marine Corps, and I was nearsighted that I had no way of knowing where the heck the land was. I couldn't see it. I'd crash. He said it was the worst he had ever seen. So then when I got drafted, I went to the infantry then. So I couldn't play baseball, and I was a left-handed batter, and every ball I hit was over the third baseman's head if it was a single or a ground ball where I struck out. And so I wasn't very good. So I wound up playing the game that I was good at and played and loved to play.
Did your parents, obviously they're from Italy, but Spain. But did they understand your love of basketball?
Well, my mom died when I was 10 or 11, and my sister was 13, and so she sort of raised the family. My dad was working three shifts, 7 to 3, 3 to 11, 11 to 7, so sometimes you didn't see him. And he drank a lot of whiskey in his time, but he never missed a day until he had a back operation, but it was hard to get some kind of direction from him, but you had to behave anyway. But at that time, World War II was going, they had and the guys at the club. And then my first real coaching influence was my basketball coach at Liberty High School, Joseph Prelitz, who was a Rutgers grad, a Rutgers All-American, actually, in football, and just the most magnificent influence I ever had.
In what way, Coach?
Well, he made sure. He used to pull your ears. If you got a C on your report card, if you came with a C and you showed your report card, he'd just grab you by the ear and twist it till you went down on your knees. And you were crying, oh, tears. It hurt so much. And he'd say, you know, as a matter of fact, I told you not to get any C's, as though that was so important. And so he coached basketball the way they're playing today. I mean, I had a lot of trouble getting started in college because he believed in taking 100 shots a game. Hmm. And, of course, my friends told me I took most of them. But we shot a lot of shots. And we won. We were 24-3 2 years in a row. And
yeah, you played on some terrific high school teams.
Oh, yeah, they were good. We were good. And we had good. And they were all at the Hall of Fame ceremonies. I was so happy to see all of them. And
I remember, I mean, you have a terrific memory. You've talked about the three losses. I mean, you remember each of those games.
Well, we lost to Reading. At Reading, because we played in a bandbox, and we used to call that the track, the racetrack, so big. Then we lost to Allentown twice or three times. So we lost four games, 23-4, and they lost their title. They lost their title, championship title that year, because they had been failing guys in the early years, and so most. Where four or five of them graduated, they were overage. They participated overage, and so they lost their title. And the next year, we were 23-4 again. And then we lost to Norristown in the Eastern Finals in a game that I was really bad. I turned terribly, terrible I played. And it sort of showed some of the flaws of our system, because that team was more conservative, and we didn't have a match for that. We were shot, and I learned something from that. But he was the most impressive figure, and more meticulous in his teaching and everything that matters in life. He countered, and I'll never forget the year we went to the NIT and won it in 1975 here at Princeton. He came to the Lehigh Valley All-Star banquet, and after it was over, we talked, and he was so proud of what I had done that I was catching his tears in my right hand when he was crying. I couldn't get over that. He was so proud, and I'll never forget him. It was such a factor. Two of the most influential guys in my life was he was one, and Coach Van Bredekoff, who was here. I met him at Lafayette.
Yeah, you mentioned Coach Van Bredekoff, and so when did you first meet him? Because you played for Coach at Lafayette.
Lafayette College.
So how did that process work for you?
Well, I had to learn how to play.
Do you remember how you got recruited?
Yeah, they thought I was – first of all, I went to Rutgers to get recruited, and the guy thought I was too little. And it's funny. We played him four times kind of our freshman year, and we won 7 out of the 8 games. And seven. We didn't play the 8th game because I needed so many points to score 1,000, and it was a big snowfall, and their coach didn't want to reschedule the game. And Van Bredekoff got on the phone and called that guy every name under the sun, but he wouldn't change his mind. But it didn't matter to me. Van Bredekoff was really a wonderful coach, and he had to change the way I was playing.
And what did he do?
Well, it sort of started me thinking about using my head a little bit, little cerebral parts of the game, that when you shoot 100 times a game, you're shooting quickly, and you think you can make every shot. You want to speed up the game. And then we pressed all over the court in high school, full court 2 years in a row. And so we encouraged them to shoot fast too. And in most cases, we were better at it than they were. And but then when I went to college, I had trouble my freshman year, my sophomore year. Making a transition, which a lot of guys have. And finally, I ran to the coach, and I was afraid that when he got the job, that they said he didn't like little guys. He didn't like short players. So I worked out all summer. I really played every day.
You knew who he was.
Right. I saw him play, actually. Yeah. And he was like sort of a hatchet man for the Knicks. And
Describe his style, Coach, because he coached here.
When you go think about his style, I think you got to go to his days as a player at Princeton. Because they had a coach here by the name, what the heck is his name? He coached football. And
this is Cappy Capone.
Cappy Capone. How could I forget something like that? Except I was just 86 the other day. It explains a lot. And Brett Kopp always would say that he was a terrific coach and was underrated as a coach because he coached football too. And they said he was a genius as a coach in football. And then when I got the job, I looking over some old record books and stuff like that. Every time they went to the NCAA, they got beat, but it was always like 1 point or 3 points, something like that. And so you could see that guy could have coached on a national level if he wanted to. And they said he was really, really bright. And so I think his influence on Bambretikoff plus his influence of Joe Lapchick on Bambretikoff together started the mold of a really fine coach.
Mm-hmm.
And so
Lapchick being the coach of the Knicks.
Right, mm-hmm. And he's really good. And so when he got there, he started working on me, on playing smarter, and he still wanted me to shoot, which made me happy. But I started playing a little smarter, and I had a good career there. And I picked up some of his, most all of his things. That he's got a reputation for being a little bit too independent for modern, and he always had a good time, and he was never a guy that joined anything. He was very independent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. If he had been a little different, his behavior had been a little different, I think he would have made it. But that's played against him because he had great victories over Notre Dame. How could a team like Lafayette beat Notre Dame? That's unbelievable. And what he did here at Princeton was he had Bradley, and Bradley was a key guy. But I've always felt that his role on the team was never appreciated. Bradley got more credit than he should have.
The guys from the Bambretikoff era speak very highly of Butch's boys, right?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's the only guy that ever liked him was Will Chamberlain.
And what was that story?
Oh, he said he was the worst coach he ever had when he coached in the pros, the Lakers. And when he told me that story, and I read it in the book and that Will wrote, and I said, well, if he says you're bad, that means you're good.
Right. Didn't he say, I take that as a compliment?
That's right. Yeah. So, but then, of course, there are guys that love that guy. But I became a Bill Russell fan. It was, to me, watching him play influenced the way I coached in a lot of ways, and the Celtics. And Red Auerbach, who always said was an affable despot, but their style of playing, involving the team, moving the ball around, they would fast break a lot. And we didn't hear at Princeton that much. I don't know that I ever coached a real fast team here that could do that. See, we're out rebounded. One time, Bambretikoff, when I was a coach in Reading, so mad at his team because they got a rebound. He said, what do you do? But guys are out rebounding every game. I said, They're letting us jump on our backs. And as I, when I got here, one year we were 23-4 here. We were out rebounded in 27 games. So how do you do that? You know, a statistic like that is so important. But we took good shots, made a lot of them, and didn't throw the ball away. So two of the three things that count, we were good at.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I bring up advanced statistics to you, and you point out that these are the things that advanced statistics tell you. Take care of the ball. Take
right.
good shots.
Right. Right.
You were skipping ahead a little bit, Coach. I want right. to, I want, if I can, go back to right after Lafayette, you,
well,
you
I went
started
into,
teaching.
No, I went in the service for 2 years.
Okay.
And the Korean War was going on, and I got my orders from Korea, for Korea, and the war ended. So they couldn't they save money. They didn't send me overseas. And I was glad because shooting, I had to shoot a rifle. And I'm left-handed that. When I would go to look through the where the bolt is, I think they call it a bolt, the thing that comes back and hits you, and you aim your sights. If I shot left-handed, that bolt would knock my eye out. So I had to shoot right-handed, and oh man, it was so bad and pathetic, which explained a lot for me. That explained a lot. That and also the fact that I struck out in baseball so often, I didn't see the ball on time. Hmm. And it turned out basketball being so big, the ball being so big, it didn't have that much of an impact. Yet, my shots from the corner weren't as accurate as my shot from the front. So
I don't feel so bad. I mean, there were a number of us that were sent as players up to get their eyes checked.
Right.
Yeah, I was one of them. You sent me to get my eyes checked.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the ways that you kind of, you know, but there was a truth there, you know, because a lot of guys have some issues. But also, it was sort of the first, you know, it was, can't you see, you know?
Right. Well, I think you could see. I don't know.
Well,
what the reason
the
for
point,
was.
The point was is if you're throwing the ball away in practice, you know, it was, why don't you go get your eyes checked?
I could have been being sarcastic.
Well, yeah, there was some of that.
Right.
But
as I said to you many times and tell people, I wasn't the easiest guy to play
no,
for.
No.
And you agreed with that, which makes you an honest guy. That's fine. All right. That's right. I don't know why. I think if I coached now, I'd be a little less rough. That's the right way. Mm. I wouldn't be that much of a disciplinarian. It'd be a lot more understanding. Is that the result of older age or whether I see things that I could do that are differently? It's hard to say because I can't go backwards and go back to my 30s and 40s, but... I like to be exact, and I got mm-hmm. that from Ben Bredikoff. As a matter of fact, I learned more English, it's hard to believe, from that guy. Because every time you made a talk and you said grammatical error, he'd correct you.
Hmm.
And he busted out of Princeton because he didn't want to stay here. He was an All-American soccer player and a very good basketball player. He went in the Marine Corps and came back out and was a great athlete here. Just a different kind of a man that you'd see. You know, it all depends how you look at it. He was either great, and some guys didn't like him, but that's...
What did your father think of him?
Well, my father didn't know anything about it. He never learned how to speak English, a little bit. It bothered the heck out of me. And my sister and I would try to get him to talk, and he wouldn't. He was afraid. The guy was, I often said to my sister and I talk about that, he was afraid of modern life, which is what it was here in this country. And he never missed a day of work except that he had a hernia operation, and I guess he was out 60 days and back to work he went. I don't know if they do that today. But... He just noticed the letters A, B, C, D, or no, at that time it was E. he was excellent, and F was failing, and he just noticed that if you got low grades, he'd get angry as heck, and I respected him a lot. I mean, he had a tough job,
mm-hmm.
right?
When you were, you know, I guess I'm from after you got in the service, you did start teaching, and
yeah, I started teaching at Easton High School.
And what did you teach?
Well, there I taught American history and University of Pennsylvania. I taught Pennsylvania history. And that was in eighth grade. I taught eighth and ninth grade.
Mm-hmm. Did you start coaching?
And I was junior varsity coach. And
didn't you coach football as well?
Well, it was fun. They couldn't find a football coach there. And so I went and coached at Wolf Junior High School. And then I went to the Easton Junior High. And right then there, I had a team of kids that were so good, they went on to the varsity and won, I guess, 50 games and lost one. And I remember telling the story on TV one time that we were undefeated, unscored upon. And the guy got a phone call. I recognized the guy's voice after all those years. Robert Kelly, he says, Coach Krill, he says, we didn't go undefeated. Remember March, they scored a touchdown on us the last game. So I said, Robert, you just ruined one of the best stories I ever told. And so I did coach. But then I got to the point after 4 years, I needed the money. I started teaching at $2,600 a year and $400 for coaching junior varsity basketball, $200 for coaching football, and $175 for coaching baseball. And in baseball, I coached the son of the superintendent of schools, and Edward Tracy, he's a good guy, and his son Steve was slow as molasses. And I remember telling him, you know, he hit the ball, but he can't run that fast. He said, what do you mean? He's the fastest guy in the block. And so right field, we played at Cottingham Stadium. It's a football stadium. So right field is like 100 yards, if that, mm-hmm. from first, not yeah. 100 yards.
Less than that, but
it, yeah. It was an easy shot. Mm-hmm. They called it a double every time he hit the stands. So he hit a ground liner, ground ball in between second and first, and the right fielder threw him out at first base, and he was in the stands. And I waved to him. I said, holy smokes, I guess he's slow. But he was a good guy. And then when the writing job opened up, it was a challenge because that's a basketball school in Easton at the time, and still is to a certain extent a football power. And their basketball is big and has been big, and they still have played in an arena. At that time was like, we call it a racetrack. It was a junior high school gym that seated 2,300, and now they have a high school gym that seats 4,000.
And when I was in one of the tournaments that we all go to as coaches is called Hoop Group, and in Albright College is right there, and I went over and drove over there, and the junior high gym you're describing, I mean, would be – one of the nicest high school gyms in the country right now. I mean, it is an incredible place.
Right.
That's not – and then when did they build the high school gym?
They built the high school after I left. Mm-hmm. After I left.
And you left?
I left in 1967.
To go take the job at Lehigh.
Yeah, I took the job at Lehigh.
Now,
right.
What was that process like?
Well, I got interesting stories to tell about all
this. I know. We're going to get through all of them.
All right. So what happened was that three guys applied for the job, and it was probably
you remember who the other two were?
Yeah. It was probably the worst job in the history of the school. And one was John Carpenter, who eventually got the writer job. And another was a high school coach from Allerton, Wisconsin. And so they gave the job to the writer coach. And on the way to accept, driving from Gettysburg, freshman coach at Gettysburg, he got a phone call from Ryder. They offered him the job there. Well, Ryder was a better job, basketball-wise. He just stopped in it, and Ryder took the job. So I found out about after the athletic director, who was a good Joe. I really liked him a lot. He offered a job to me. The other guy was from Appleton, Wisconsin, whose name I never did know, but they didn't want to fly him in. I guess that's what it was. And I liked him as a boss because he would say, yes, I can do it, or no, I can't. That was the end of it. Then beat around the bush telling you why I couldn't do something. Can't do it. And I had a rebounding machine, McCaw thing. It was called a McCaw rebounder. Those things I always thought was a gadget. So I said, can I sell that for a film of the game, one of our games? He said, go ahead. And so I did. And I that's the kind of guy he was. And we had a losing season, but we had a historic win over Rutgers. And they were nationally ranked at the time, and they had Jim Valvano and Bob Lloyd, I think, who's made 58 foul shots in a row, trying to make 60, and we beat them 43-41. And they carried me off the court there. It was interesting. So,
were you staying in touch at the time with Coach Van Bredekhoff? I mean, obviously you're probably following the Princeton teams.
Right. He'd always call me to see how I was doing and vice versa. He was doing very well. He couldn't believe we beat Rutgers because that was one of the biggest games in New Jersey at the time. They built that up as, really a great game, and Princeton wiped them out. Just like one year we played Rutgers and they were talking about an undefeated season. And we beat them 90-something to 60-something. It got to the point where Roger Gord was a manager of the team. He's around here. He's an institution by himself. And I said, would you like to play, Roger? So he went in and they got him a uniform. He got in the game. And with 40 seconds to go, he took a shot and made it. And that tape has never been seen since then.
Right. We know where it is.
That's right. It was 16 millimeters. Nobody's ever seen that. But it was amazing that night. We won so badly. But anyway, I got the job at Princeton.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you have a sense that Butch was going to leave? Or when did he tell you?
No, he told me after we went out to see the finals. I went to finals in Louisville, and then we came back, and then he called to tell me he was going to take the Laker job. He didn't tell me. But he brought me along because he wanted to see how I'd get along with Art Hyland, who was assistant coach at that time. And Van Bredekhoff was never one that, if he told you what he thought, he just thought that Artie wasn't ready, and he'd come to watch his practice. I had two guards, Gary Walters, who came here, became AD at Reading, and a guy named Rodney Fogelman, who, if I'd just been a little bit more careful, a little smarter than I am, we needed a point guard, and he was so frail, and I didn't think enough of the importance of what he did to the team, because on our team in high school, we were 25-1. Everybody recognized how good he was. I think about that, and I often told him that was the biggest mistake I ever made, but he didn't think so. It sort of made me feel good about it. Because when you're in coaching, you make a lot of mistakes. I mean, you want to make sure you make as few as you can. There are times during the course of the game when you make a tough decision, and sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't. But you make the mistakes in your judgment of who can play and who can't play. And that's sometimes a little rough. And one of the interesting things about the job at Princeton is the procedure for applying for the job is so different in contrast when you apply for this job here. And first thing you did, I went to see Joe Heiser, who was captain of the team, and Mr. Fairman, AD at the time, said, "Why don't you tell him how you beat Rutgers?" So I told him. And then he looked at Joe, and he winked. Said, "Oh, that's one. That looks good." Then he brought a guy named Erling Dorf, who was a geology guy. How I can remember that, except I got to know him as a respectful guy. And he tells, Fairman goes, "How'd you beat Rutgers?" So I had to tell him. And as he walks out the door, the side where the hinges are were open. I could see him, and he stopped, and he looks back at Fairman and shook his head like that. It's two votes. And the third was a dean of students here. God, he smoked a pipe, but I forget his name. He was a great guy. Came down to talk to the team after every game. Well, I went home and told my wife then, I said, "You know, I applied for the F&M job, didn't get it, I deserved that job. I applied for the Muhlenberg job, I deserved that job, didn't get it. Here's a job that I don't know if I want it, I don't know if I deserve it." A week later, I got a call, I went down there, and it was offered to me.